All right. The time being somewhat close to 8:15, and we are close to having quorum. We will get started this morning with the first couple bills that we have up. There's a little presentation to begin with, and so I'll call Representative Miller up, and when we have the ability to, we will call and pull up House File 714 first. So, Representative Miller, to your bill, House File 714.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and thank you for having us here this morning. We have good news and bad news in Minnesota. The bad news is that we have pretty serious issues related to human trafficking. The good news is the state of Minnesota, thanks to landmark legislation in 2011 and the great work of many of the people that you'll hear today and others throughout the state, we're also leading the nation on how to deal with this terrible situation. Without further ado, I'm going to let them tell the story. So first I have, talking to House File 714, Jeff Bauer with Family Partnership.
Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Jeff Bauer. I'm the Vice President of Public Affairs at the Family Partnership. And just thanks so much for the opportunity to be here today. That truly was the shortest intro ever. Representative Miller said he was going to be brief. So I will take it from there. But I'm going to start by thanking Representative Miller. As so many of you know, he's been a great leader on this issue. And it's been a pleasure to work with him and see his passion for this. So thank you for that. Also have to say a quick thank you to Ms. Larson for all of her help coordinating and getting ready for testimony today. I appreciate that a lot. So I want to just give a brief recap of where we've been, because it's been a number of years, and I know there are a few new members of the committee now. And that is, leading up to 2011, when Minnesota passed our safe harbor law, there were two things that we were noticing in Minnesota, two really alarming trends. And we saw them in our own program serving children who've been trafficked at my organization. The first part of that trend was there were just more and more kids coming through our program. The numbers started going up very rapidly. And the second thing that we noticed was that the average age of those youth was getting younger. And that was really mirroring what people were seeing all around the state. So we set out to do something. So as Representative Miller said, not that I remember the date, and it's not burned in my brain, July 20th, 2011, Minnesota passed our safe harbor law. We were the fifth state in the country to pass the safe harbor law. And what that law said was that if you're under the age of 18 in Minnesota, you can no longer be criminalized for your own exploitation. That was a really big deal. One thing that a lot of people don't know about Minnesota's safe harbor law is although we passed it in 2011, it didn't go into effect until 2014. And you might think that's kind of strange to wait 3 years for a law to go into effect, but there was a reason for that. And the reason was that our friends in law enforcement and others, and you're going to hear from some great law enforcement leaders in a little bit, wanted to do the right thing at that time too. And we would have conversations that would go something like this. I don't think this young woman is a criminal any more than you do. I don't want to take her to juvenile detention. Where do you want me to take her? And the problem at that time was that the answer in so many cases and so many places in the state of Minnesota was, there's nowhere to take this young person. And so we didn't want to change the law until we had the alternate support model for these youth. So when we started out in 2011, I'll tell you, we had two shelter beds in the entire state of Minnesota for sex trafficked youth in 2011. They were both in St. Paul. We had almost no services specifically for trafficked youth anywhere in the state, and we had almost no law enforcement personnel trained either to identify victims or to investigate these cases. So I'm going to fast forward. 2012, we spent the year designing what would Minnesota's alternate response be. Minnesota's safe harbor, no wrong door model. Probably heard of that. We got everyone together, law enforcement, survivors, advocates, to talk about if we could build a better response for exploited youth in Minnesota, what would it be? So we presented that report to the legislature in 2013. It had a $13.3 million price tag. And some of you on this committee are very used to hearing me say the number $13.3 million because we've been back every year since then, getting a little bit further down the road. And I have a lot of fondness for a lot of you on this committee because you've helped us get there, and you've pushed really hard for this over the years. So where are we right now? We've gone from two dedicated shelter beds in the entire state of Minnesota to over 40 shelter beds available for sex trafficked youth. We've gone from almost no services in a lot of parts of the state to some really great comprehensive supportive services around the state for kids in the traffics. We've gone from almost no law enforcement with training on this issue to over 2,000 now law enforcement personnel around the state who are both trained to identify victims and to investigate these cases. That's a lot of progress in the last 4 years. We went from $0 of state investment in this issue to now $11 million of state investment in solving this issue. That's a lot of progress in 4 years. That being said, remember the number, right? 13.3 million. So House File 714, the one you see before you today, represents the remaining 2.3 million to get us to that 13.3 million. What that will do is it will get us more shelter beds in more parts of the state. There are still places in the state where a victim is identified and there's nowhere to bring them, and we need to fix that. That will get us more comprehensive services in more parts of the state and more training to people all across the state to handle these cases better. The other thing I just want to say about this bill is that we really want to focus on Greater Minnesota. It's amazing, as we've done these trainings, especially for law enforcement around the state, it's almost immediate the change in how law enforcement is handling these cases and how rapidly they're starting to identify victims. I remember we did a training up in the Brainerd area. They had never had a sex trafficking case that they had worked on or reported up there. Within a week of that training, they had already identified their first case. That's how it's happening. And so the more training we do, the more of these youth we're finding, the more of the need to build this system. So, what I want to do, is that okay, Rep. Miller? Is it time to, if it's okay, Mr. Chair, is bring up our next two testifiers for you?
That would be great.
One of the real privileges I've had in this work is getting to work with some of our young survivor leaders who have made it through this and who are now working to build something better for youth just like them. So you're going to hear from one of them. And also I'm going to bring up, so that's Cindy Williams. She's going to come up. She's waving back here. And then Beth Holger Ambrose, who is the executive director of The Link, which provides shelter and housing and services and all kinds of good things for exploited youth. So I'm excited for you to hear from them. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Bauer, for your testimony this morning. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Beth Holger Ambrose. I'm the executive director of The Link. And I wanted to start by saying thank you all so much for your support of young people who have been victimized by sex trafficking. We really appreciate all of that's been done. We have a lot more to do still, but incredible progress has been made because of your support, so thank you so much. The Link, if you're not familiar, we're a nonprofit that's based here in the Twin Cities, and we have three areas of focus. We provide juvenile justice, alternative programs, housing and supportive services for young people and young families experiencing homelessness, and then we're a very proud partner of the state's Safe Harbor, No Wrong Door response, in that we provide an emergency shelter, housing program, and many supportive services, as well as the West Metro Regional Navigator for our Safe Harbor response and No Wrong Door response. What I wanted to just say is that even though it is incredible that we have the 40 shelter beds now, and we really appreciate that, the funding for our shelter, nearly 50% of that comes through the state Safe Harbor funds. The rest of it we raise through private foundations, faith-based contributions, and things of that nature. But thank you. We just want to thank you so much, because it wouldn't be possible to do the work we do without your support. However, in 2016, we just did our year-end program reports. We served 67 unduplicated youth. Many of those victims of sex trafficking had open investigations pending with their traffickers. And unfortunately, today and every day, we're full. Our passageway shelter for trafficked youth is full. We have 7 youth on the waiting list today. And on our housing program for sex trafficked youth is also full, and we have 11 youth on that waiting list. So our work is not done, and people oftentimes ask us to expand or build capacity to serve more youth. And all of that takes, obviously, is additional resources. So we're here today to support this bill for additional resources to the $13.3 million. And before I move on to Simeana, who is an an amazing leader that I've had the privilege to work with for the past 3.5 years, I want to just mention one story of the many 67 youth that we served in the past year. I'll call this young person Sarah. She's a girl from St. Paul, 15 years old, that was being sex trafficked between Minnesota, Texas, North Dakota, and many other states. When she went before, she did end up going before the Ramsey County Juvenile Courts, and during that process, they did court order her to our program because she had apparently failed in many other placements, and they were worried about her running away. And so, unfortunately, she was brought to our program in handcuffs, which we don't typically agree philosophically with, because the officers and the judge in the case were so worried about her running away. Since the time she entered the program, she was attending our on-site school regularly with a partnership with Prior Lake School District. She participated in case management, mental health therapy, and when she went back for her next court hearing, thanked the judge for sending her to Passageways. And she now has moved from the shelter side of our program to the housing side, is working on finding a job, has never run away once, never had any behavior problems in our program. And so just to say that these types of investments that you're making make an incredible difference. And she also hasn't been sex trafficked, obviously, again, since entering our program. So with that, I would like to just say thank you so much and allow the majority of the time to be spent by Simeana and the other testifiers.
Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you for having me here, the chair, and the rest of the committee. My name is Simeana Williams. I am on the Survivors Advisory Committee, and I help Beth create Passageways. She said, well, if you guys, had a place, we're building this place, or whatever, and she's like, well, if you guys had a place to call home, what would it be like, and everything like that. So everything that we didn't have is what we put into Passageways. I mean, everything. I mean, from security to the colors of the walls to everything, to the kitchen, to what we wanted to eat, from everything, the services, everything. We knew that we needed help, but we didn't have the right kind of help. So... Okay, I mean, we knew that we needed help and everything, so for Beth to come with us with this idea is just like, it's overwhelming, because no one's ever come and asked us, what would you like, and then you actually see it happening, it's there. We're helping these girls, we're helping these people, and everything, and it's just like, that's amazing. So places like Passageways to keep being funded is, it's amazing.
Don't be nervous.
Mm-hmm.
What else would you like to say?
Okay. I'm going to say Passageways is one of the things that helped me release.
Sorry, guys.
I do what they have to hear.
Okay.
It's, it helped me release. There's so many things that I put into Passageways that these girls now have that I wish I had before. We didn't have the services, we didn't have the help, we didn't have anything. And all they did was throw us in jail. And that's not going to help anything, especially if we have these habits that it's called peer recruitment, where you're putting us in a place where there's females who have never been in the lifestyle. We're going to try to get at them because we're trained by our pimps to try and get them into the lifestyle, not even knowing that we're doing that to them. So to have a place like Passageways is, it's amazing. Thank you.
All right, and thank you, Ms. Williams, for your very touching testimony this morning. Are there questions for these testifiers? All right. Seeing none, the committee thanks you this morning for giving us your testimony. Are there any other testifiers, Representative Miller?
No, not at this time, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we do have one question, Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It really isn't much of a question. I think we're all a little stunned, but thank you very much for your testimony, for your willingness to come here and talk to us, because that's not easy. This is a highly public place, and your life has been tough.
Thank you.
And we're glad to see that there's an opportunity for you to have success in life.
Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I echo that. I'm over here. Yeah. Thanks so much for your testimony. My question is, what happens to those young people when you have a waiting list? Where do they go when they can't get in?
Ms. Holger Ambrose.
Thank you for that question, members of the committee and chair. What we try to do is we have mobile staff that work through our regional navigator to help them. It's not easy. We attempt to find another shelter bed through partners with the domestic violence or homeless youth programs, which is why it's so critical that they also be funded. And then we try to provide those specific services for sexually exploited youth through our mobile mental health therapists and West Metro Regional Navigator staff. But it is incredibly challenging, and there's not always beds open within domestic violence or homeless youth shelters. So then in other situations, sometimes this is not perfect, and I know our state funders are in the room, but in a pinch, sometimes we'll do a few nights at a hotel or something like that, and then provide the services there. But it's definitely very challenging, which is why we are really hoping that you'll continue to support the extended funding to add more beds and housing.
Okay. Any other questions for the testifiers? All right. Any final comments for Representative Miller on House File 714?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, for hearing this. I ask that you, I believe this is being referred to public safety, is that correct?
Right. I'll call the meeting to order in just a second.
But oh, that's right. I apologize, but that's all I have to say. Thank you.
All right. I will officially call the meeting to order and then move that House File 714 be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. House File 714 has been re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. I will move now House File 713 to also be referred to the Committee on Public Safety. Representative Miller, to your bill.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. As you've heard from this incredible testimony here this morning, that there's been a lot of good work with youth. There's more work to do in the state of Minnesota, but the when it refers to, we also have trafficked adults, of course, but how? So, The safe harbor law that was passed works very good for youth, but does not translate very well to the adult sector. There are some challenges there, and we've had some discussions. Many people in this room have had conversations about what we should do. And Mr. Bauer and I talked over the last year and came to the conclusion that we should perhaps take the same course of how they originally founded the safe harbor journey. They did a strategic plan back in, was it in 10 or was it in 11?
12.
In 12. They did the strategic plan in order to move forward, and we believe that that's the best path. So what this bill does is this goes through the Department of Health. They're not going to do the strategic plan. The Department of Health is going to put out a competitive bid to one of the many great groups that does this sort of work, and they're going to bring all the stakeholders in to discuss what it is we want to do. And Mr. Bauer will speak a little bit to that, and then I have two other testifiers who are doing incredible work up in Stearns County that I think will attest to why this is important to take this course of action at this time.
Mr. Bauer, welcome back to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair and members. Jeff Bauer, Vice President of Public Affairs at the Family Partnership. Thanks for the opportunity to testify on another bill today. I didn't get a chance to do it the first time, but I also want to acknowledge Representative Susan Allen, who is now here in the committee, who was a very great early leader on these safe harbor bills, and I want you to know how much we appreciate your leadership early on, Representative Allen. We've talked a lot about the youth piece, and last year, if some of you on the committee will recall, another change that we made was that we extended eligibility for safe harbor, shelter, and services through the age of 24. We didn't change the law, so the safe harbor law is still under 18, but eligibility for shelter and services was through 24. And we did that to acknowledge this point. If you've been exploited since you were 12, 13, 14 years old, you cannot wake up on your 18th birthday and suddenly have a choice as an adult to get out of that life of exploitation. It simply doesn't work that way. And I'll tell you from our program at the Family Partnership and many, many, many conversations I've had with the adult women in that program, I have actually never had one of those conversations where it hasn't come to light that the exploitation in that person's life started when they were a child. It always starts there somehow. So we're at this point now where we've done this incredible work in Minnesota on safe harbor for sexually exploited youth. We've extended these services and acknowledged that youth doesn't end the day you turn 18 and all of a sudden you have a choice in this matter. So House File 713 is our attempt to take the next step and talk about what are we doing about adults who are going through the same exploitation, the same trafficking, and are not criminals. They are victims of exploitation. I'll tell you from my conversations all around the state, there's a pretty strong consensus about that. From law enforcement, from advocates, from survivors, from a lot of people, that these adults should not be criminalized. What I'll say honestly in this committee is there has been sort of less consensus about what to do with that knowledge, how to move forward with that knowledge. And so as Representative Miller said, I feel like we're in a very similar place as we were on Safe Harbor for Youth back in maybe 2010, 2011, which is we know exactly what we have to do, but we're not quite sure how to do it yet. And so the bill represents, as Representative Miller said, a very similar planning process, convening of stakeholders across the state, and you're going to hear from some of our amazing law enforcement allies on this issue in just a minute, to put together, if Minnesota could have a better response for adult victims, what would it be? What would the components be? What would law enforcement do? What would agencies do? Come back with a plan and put it in front of all of you and talk about what we can build that's better for adult victims. So I ask for your support on this bill, and Representative Miller, I think, will introduce our next testifiers.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Bauer. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could call forward my two next presenters. These are the superheroes that are doing this work. In Stearns County, I've been privileged to be part of a group that's been getting together, and I've gotten to know these two. Some incredible work that they're doing out there, and as I said before, I'll say again, I really want to leave the testifying to the people who truly know what they're doing, and so I know that they'll introduce themselves formally, but I'm very proud to bring here Janelle Kendall, the county attorney for Stearns, and Chief Dave Bentley from Wake Park. But I'll let them go ahead and talk to why this next step, what they've been doing, and what it is that we're doing next.
All right. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and then give us your testimony.
My name is Dave Benchwood, and I'm police chief in Wake Park. We're part of the St. Cloud metro area. Mr. Chair and the members of the committee, I really appreciate the opportunity to share a little bit about what we've been working on in our area. And just for a little background, I've been in law enforcement for about 25 years. I spent most of my career with St. Cloud PD and now as chief in Wake Park. And I suspect that prostitution was occurring at some level 25 years ago. But something changed in the last 5 years, I would say, in our area. And for me, it kind of started with a call I received from an investigator. Statewide trafficking task force was looking for a missing juvenile female out of the Twin City metro area. And they found her in my city at one of the hotels. And when I heard that, I realized that kind of victimization could be occurring in my city, I kind of took it personal. And so I asked one of my investigators to start the process of kind of digging into what is the scope of the problem in our community, in our area. And I asked Sergeant DeShane at the time, Investigator DeShane at the time, to start looking at the issue, like I said. And it was, I was shocked. We started looking at a lot of social media websites. And the number of postings for women soliciting themselves was significant. Locations listed include Wade Park and St. Cloud. And I pretty much knew then that we had a serious problem. We started doing what we call a series of knock-and-talks at some of the hotels in the area, just trying to find out, again, what's the scope of the issue, the problem. And while we have had contact with a few juvenile females, it's mostly been, I would say, younger adults, probably 18 to 25 years of age, that we've had contact with. I'd say in the last 5 years, we've identified 150 women that have been trafficked in the St. Cloud metro area. Of those, we would estimate about 65 to 70% of those women are actually being trafficked by somebody. In other words, there's an element of coercion control that is facilitating this activity. And we have been operating, I would describe, probably more informally. We don't have a formalized task force, that's trafficking task force in our area, although I would like to. If we could find the funding, we need to, quite frankly. We have made several arrests for those who are soliciting for prostitution. We have made several felony-level arrests for individuals, men, soliciting for sex with underage girls. We have a huge problem, and why, I don't know. I can't necessarily define for you why it's occurring, why in our particular area, but I would submit it's probably happening all over the state of Minnesota, in fact, all over the country. We've identified women that have been trafficked in our area from as far away as Nevada, Texas, and California. We had a lot of this culminated with a shooting that we had at one of our local motels in where there was a 16-year-old juvenile female who was a runaway out of Hubbard County. She was in our city. She was being trafficked by a group of confirmed gang members. In that particular, we had a shooting that night that did not involve the victim. In this case, and other rival gang members. But we had a shooting. We had narcotics. And there was this 16-year-old girl being trafficked out of one of the rooms in our hotel. And again, I have to say that I take that very personal. I don't want that in my city. I don't want that in our area. And it's just one of those things. We looked at probably solicitors of prostitution probably come from an area about 80-mile radius of St. Cloud. Why St. Cloud, Wade Park? Well, I think for one of the reasons is until recently we weren't able to put a lot of pressure on them. They could pretty much do what they wanted to do. We've tracked women from the Twin Cities to St. Cloud Metro out to the oil fields. I mean, it's just that kind of activity. And again, working rather informally in our investigator group, we've had investigators from St. Cloud, Wade Park, Sartell, Cold Spring. Our violent offender task force have allocated personnel to focus on this as they can. There's a lot of other calls that we're dealing with as well. And we've been pretty successful at getting some traffickers sentenced to prison for a very, very long time. So, again, just working at this rather, I don't want to say informally, but I guess that's, you know, we're not formally structured. We've had a lot of success. We've identified two primary shortcomings or gaps right now, is that we need to do some things to allocate more law enforcement resources to the issue, investigative resources. We also need to figure out a way to provide safe housing. We lack some of those resources to be able to get women out of the lifestyle. We obviously need victims of trafficking to talk to us and let us know who's involved, who's trafficking them, and we can really increase our odds of getting the kind of information that we need that can lead to convictions if we can provide them with a safe alternative. We just can't take the information, thank you very much, let them go back out on the street, back to their pimp. It just can't happen that way. So we've recognized that we need to do some things to support the victims of trafficking with some kind of safe housing. And we've got some things in place. We're trying to work on that. So I probably talked enough. Maybe I'll turn it over to Janelle and you can share what's...
Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Janelle Kendall. I'm the Stearns County Attorney. And as Chief Benford said, when you were all working on this back in 2011, I was on the board of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association with John Choi. And Choi says, Kendall, up in St. Cloud, you've got the highest demand outside the metro area. It doesn't happen in Lake Wobegon. No, no. And once we started to look at this, what County Attorney Choi challenged me to do is look at every runaway file in my office, is look at the juvenile files that were going on in my office, and he assured me that I would find it right there in things that were already sitting in front of our face. He was absolutely right. As Chief Benford said, in 2014, we had a drive-by shooting at one of the hotels in his town. And when you realize then that you have a 16-year-old girl from a town population 438, in your town, in this place, we got St. Cloud on board, and what I end up seeing is not only what comes in from Waite Park, but also from St. Cloud, also from Sauk Center, all the way out. So far, as the Chief said, we have approximately 150 persons identified so far. Most of them are female. Harder to find the juveniles because they're easier to hide. They're less likely to speak up. The challenges that come with those juveniles are there. But at the same time, what we've been able to do in those 150 persons so far is have people like this, trained by people like Jeff Bauer, to go out and talk to them. Not going to say that we're never going to prosecute someone in a situation like that. Sometimes it's that leverage that allows her to say to her pimp, look, I got things I got to deal with now, and now I've got some pressures on me. It's complicated, and one of the things that we want to bring to you is not only the size of the problem in the outstate, but the complications of dealing with this. So far in what we've done, we've got 112 sex buyers, Johns, as they would say. They are middle-aged, white, employed, married men, most of them from the demographic that would be St. Cloud. So just in three officers working part-time in one summer, we came up with 112 of those arrests. It's like shooting fish in a barrel. It's that easy. As the Chief said, nobody was paying any attention. So once we started paying attention, that's there. But in that same time frame, we've convicted 8 traffickers, pimps. These are career criminals, people. These are not. This is not some sort of an accident that we run across them. They're selling drugs one day. They're selling women the same day. But they can sell her 15 times for every time they can sell the drugs. We're finding people with criminal histories as long as your arm. Most of them have backgrounds in domestic violence. The one that we sent for 27 years had already been convicted of pimping, is what they call the crime in Iowa. So in St. Cloud, we've got 8 so far without even having a real tight plan to get it. Once you know what you're asking, we've developed a high-risk protocol that we've now trained all the schools in. So every time an officer or a teacher comes in contact with someone who is considered high-risk, runaway, for example, that's one of the reasons that you hear people talk about, from the dawn of time when girls are running away, what are we afraid happens? This is not mystical, magical stuff. It really isn't. This has been going on since the dawn of time. But the fact that we're finally recognizing what it is and doing something about it, I was called out to Congress that Eric Paulson called us and said, we're going to have a national roundtable on trafficking. Would you come and speak? I didn't realize till I got there the reason I was there is because Lake Wobegon had got the memo. That's literally what they said to me in Washington, D.C. If it's happening in St. Cloud and you recognize it, and we're picking up girls from Avon, Representative Tice is here from our county. She knows that one of the first conversations that St. Cloud PD had was an officer speaking to a girl who lives six doors down from him in Avon, Minnesota. She's living at home. She's going to school, and she's turning tricks for her older boyfriend on the side. That's how this begins. So we very much welcome the idea of being able to have a conversation with you and with persons who understand this of what is the right thing to do, because obviously, we have to do something. We don't have any additional resources. This has to be done. My community, as an elected official, oh, my gosh, we cannot even keep up
with the amount of people who want us to come out and talk about what's going on. We've actually used criminal forfeiture funds now to create a video that we can get out to all of the schools and talk about what it is that we need people to be looking for, what kind of signs you're looking for, and what do you do, because we have such an incredible outpouring in a community of our size, Albany specifically. We've had three presentations in the town of Albany, population, what, 3,000? People get that this is going on in their town, and they do want to have these conversations. Thank you to the Minnesota Legislature and John Choi and my line of work for bringing up the fact that it does exist. But now that we got the memo that exists, we very much would appreciate the opportunity to have this considered conversation, get everyone at the table who has some interaction with this together to figure out what is the right thing to do. Because I'm not sure at this point, as the Chief said, that we all agree on what that would be. But just like we did the last time, let's get together and have that conversation, please.
All right, Ms. Kendall and Chief Bentrude, thank you for your testimony this morning. Are there questions for the testifiers? Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to really thank Representative Miller for bringing this forward, and again for all the past authors of this type of legislation. Mine is more of a statement as well as a quick update. I also think Ms. Williams is a hero in so many ways of helping save lives going forward. It takes more guts to do what she's doing today because of her actions. So I just wanted to make sure I thanked her for her incredible strength. But actually, I'm a hotel owner back in Wilmer, and this last summer we worked with the Minnesota Lodging Association. They also have a video that we went through the local convention visitors bureau that kind of helps organize all the the hotel business, and we had about six seminars at our restaurant that we provided. Every hotel employee was trained in our city. I think we have 96% participation rate, and so I just want to let you know that it's happening in Wilmer, in our area as well. We showed housekeepers and we showed our staff what to look for, and so I really encourage us as all members to talk to our communities about this is available, the video is available. We had our county attorney, our law enforcement folks, our Safe Avenue local connection, and so we felt that was an enormous wake-up call for our community as well. So thank you so much for bringing this all forward.
Thank you, Representative Baker. Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Miller, for bringing this. And it's the fifth year that this has brought to our attention, and keep making progress, so thank you, and thank the testifiers. And my question is about this study where you bring in, right now we have some treatment courts. Tribes are looking at treatment courts, and we have one in Hennepin County. Does anybody have any information about that, and whether you'll be considering that as part of this, coming up with a new strategic plan or model?
Absolutely, that makes sense to me as a prosecutor. We have a drug court. We also have a repeat felony domestic violence court in Stearns County, and our work with domestic violence victims has largely informed how we approach the women involved in these cases in terms of approaching them where they are, without judgment, without shame. All right, here's where we're at. Where are we going to get from here? And using the court as that sort of incentive to accomplish those type of things.
Mr. Bauer.
What the county attorney said is correct. Thank you.
10 minutes ago.
Representative Allen.
Thank you.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question actually is for the Chief, so if he could... First, I want to thank you for your comments about making sure that we keep our youth and our young people safe. And I appreciate the work you do. It's admirable and oftentimes goes without thanking.
Thank you.
So, but your comments and your mentioned other services, and I just wonder if you'd speak a little more to the involvement of such other federal organizations as the ATF and some of the departments of transportation, in terms of, it seems like in your comments that there is kind of a pipeline, if you will, that's coming up from Texas and through some of the adjoining states along major interstates. Maybe it's going to the Bakken, I don't know, but and the proliferation of the drugs themselves and the cartels that we hear about in terms of what involvement would ATF and some of the other federal agencies be improved or benefit, or the coordination that you have with them in terms of how we can adjoin with them more succinctly?
Chief Bentrode.
Yeah. In our area, not ATF so much, but FBI. We have two agents in our St. Cloud metro area that do very good work, and we've included them, and they've been working with us in trying to address this issue. It does appear to be somewhat of an interstate issue. Like I said, we've had girls come in from, or women come in from, you know, all over the country, really. And like I said, we've tracked them out into the oil fields, to be very direct. And so, yes, a fairly recent development is that the BCA has allocated a couple of investigators. They are now assigned to St. Cloud, and they kind of cover the northern parts of the state, as far as I understand it. Their main focus is predatory offenders, but they also have the ability to assist us in trafficking cases. So that's a positive development as well. And then, of course, locally, we've kind of been operating under a mutual aid agreements with our local agencies. But we do need to formalize that, and that's one of our goals, is to create some kind of a Central Minnesota Trafficking Task Force that includes not only law enforcement, but also prosecutors, social workers, and we're trying to come up with a funding plan to bring a team, a multidisciplinary, multi-jurisdictional team together to combat this issue. So and that was part of the issue for me as a small police agency, recognizing that we had a huge problem. I'm not big enough to have a sex crimes unit of my own. It clearly had to be a multi-jurisdictional response. Because even if I was successful in eliminating the problem in Waite Park, all I was probably going to be doing is pushing it to St. Cloud or to St. Joe or Sartell or whatever. And that's not an effective response in my mind. So it's been a little bit of an educational process. Even within law enforcement, there are some in my area that just, you know, to be very blunt, don't recognize the problem. They don't see it the same way that I've seen it. And so we've got a lot of work in some ways to educate them even on this is a serious issue. We need to work on this.
Representative Albright.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I just want to, if I could, Mr. Chair and members, I just want to punctuate what the Chief just said there. what they're doing in Stearns County is incredible work, and I think there's a willingness in the rest of the state. A lot of what we're trying to do is, and you're going to be seeing future legislation actually addressing exactly what they're saying. But the real challenge is we have buy-in in a great deal at this county level. We have the BCA, we have the FBI. We're going to need to work to get this in other parts of the state as well.
Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative Miller, that kind of feeds into my question here. I mean, this is a huge issue, and I'm so glad that Minnesota apparently is so forward-thinking in addressing it and changing the way we address the issue. But I assume that, you know, as I look at the bill, it gives the responsibility to the Commissioner of Health to pull this together, and I assume that the Commissioner of Health is willing to do this and has given you support for the idea. That would be one part of my question. The second part is talking about other states. I see in the language of the bill there's nothing about whether other states have something to offer in terms of solutions. I mean, I know Minnesota's often way ahead on things like this, and maybe we're the state that others should be learning from, but I just wonder if we shouldn't also be looking to see if other people have developed something so that we don't completely reinvent the wheel if we don't have to.
Representative Miller.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I think you hit a lot of what we're trying to do on the head. So when it comes to other states, we are actually leading. We have other states that are coming to us. We have other countries that are coming to us right now on how we're doing this. So I do believe that we are the leader, and that's to the dedication of all the people that you've seen here, plus many more. So I'll answer them in reverse order. So are we going to be working with other states? I believe that this study is going to unfold and include that sort of discussion. What are other states doing? Are they doing something that is taking the leading edge? Because, as I said in the beginning, addressing the adult issue is a lot more complicated. I'm not saying it's not complicated for youth, but we kind of have a direct path there. With adults, it's kind of difficult. So if there's any other states that have come up with the unique ways to deal with this, we certainly want to do that. And then as far as the Department of Health commissioner, yes, absolutely. The commissioner and their department is fully on board with this. When Mr. Bauer and I discussed how should we move forward, That's why we're taking this approach, because we believe that that's the best approach to take it. The way we're taking is with all this, with everyone we discuss this with, believes this is the best approach. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Follow up, Representative Luzin. Okay, Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Because let's see, Mrs. Kendall, you mentioned the Johns or the Creeps, I would call them. Because they're in that demographics and in a small community, and I sure hope it's not happening in my county or Wright County, but speaking to Representative Baker, and we have hotels, and we have one new hotel in Delano, and I've asked Representative Baker to get me some resources that we can pool together. I just texted our sheriff, Joe Haggerty, in Wright County to get together, and we'll have a conversation and spread the word and just educate and inform. But is there a program for shameful acts of the demographics, the white male? Do you take out newspaper articles? Do you have a social media to shame them for their behavior? Because it obviously is happening over and over in the community. If you could end that kind of behavior and shameful behavior, sinful behavior, in a public forum, I would hope that would end that practice.
Yes and no. The St. Cloud Times printed the pictures. In the Sunday, they did a huge article on it. And in the Sunday paper, one morning, people woke up, and there they were. I objected to that. Let me tell you why. We prosecute these guys. They go to great pain and suffering to try to get to my office so that the complaint from my office isn't sent to their home and their wife doesn't open it up, or their 14-year-old daughter doesn't open it up, and so that nobody finds out. They come in and they plead guilty generally very quickly, although we've had two or three jury trials and the jury was out about 20 minutes. My taxpayers got no time for this. Okay, that. But what happens when we do public shaming is that in a town of this size, so a girl in Albany opens up the paper and that's where she finds out that her dad is convicted of this. Now, every kid in Albany knows that. Now her teachers know that. Now her neighbors know that. Now his mother knows that and his grandmother calls him, and a couple of these guys have lost their jobs. I was honestly concerned about suicide from the secondary victims. But it's public information, and it did have the intended effect of driving down demand for about 2 months until they came right back to it. And what's really interesting about dealing with these guys, these are not first-timers. Part of the way that law enforcement goes about these things is making sure that they know the lingo. They'll actually debate with them a little bit on what it is they're buying and how much it's going to be. So that's part of what, it's public information, but what we see with the Johns is this shaming thing that doesn't just apply to them, it applies to everybody else. But it's public information, that's how it is. It happened in St. Cloud. I was expecting really bad things to happen. We had two very excited wives in my office the next morning wanting police reports, and they got them, and you know, it went better than I thought. I was terrified as to who is going to really pay the price for that shaming. Now, we also do something different in Stearns County, like our drug court. Our drug court people actually come out with convictions. Our Johns actually come out with convictions. In different agencies where different prosecutors handle these things, the Johns are diverted. And in some communities, that may be a legitimate choice for other things. That's part of what we want to talk about with this overall approach and what's going on. Because in St. Cloud, with my juries, with my demographic, people responded exactly as you did. And even though I was worried about the secondary victims and what was going to happen, it turned out that those concerns were concerns, but it just wasn't how it went. You're absolutely right. We do have a John School. Our advocates are very involved in this. One of the things that we are proposing is something that no one else is doing, is sending advocates out with law enforcement to these calls. So that the first conversation with a young woman like this, yeah, the cops are there, but it's the advocate that's able to have a confidential conversation with those women. We do it in domestic violence cases, and we find that it equips them to better decide what they're going to say, if they're going to say anything at all, how that interaction is going to go, and it makes it confidential, because whatever law enforcement has and I get, I have to give to the pimp. So we have to be careful and aware of that. So it's complicated. But these Johns, it's not first-timers that we're getting. And the demand went down temporarily, and then it came right back. So that's where we know that we've kind of got the tip of the iceberg here.
And if I could just echo that, we've hosted a couple of John schools now at Wade Park, and I agree with Janelle. I have been torn over the public disclosure of some of the arrests, and we've made a ton. And what was shocking to me when I first started reading a lot of the complaints for those that we arrested and listened to some of the phone conversations that they were having with law enforcement, they didn't know that, obviously. This was clear to me that this was not their first rodeo. I mean, they knew the lingo. They knew the street language. They had solicited before. It wasn't like, gee, I've never done this before. How does this work? You know, it was not that. And that was shocking to me. So a lot of these men show up on a Saturday morning with their hats on and sunglasses, and obviously very embarrassed. There is a lot of shaming going on. I guarantee you that. I've had a chance to sit in on and observe one of the schools, and our advocates did an excellent job. And by the end, you know, there was some guys shedding some tears, and we're trying to do it that way. I'm concerned about the impact of what this might do, and they ultimately find out. But families are affected, torn apart, and that's just kind of exacerbating the whole problem. So I'm really kind of torn as to how public we get with some of our arrests.
Thank you, Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And mostly just a comment here. In a way, I'm struggling with, I am so proud of these two and what our county has done. On the other hand, I don't want you to know what's going on because these are two rock stars. They're absolutely rock stars. And I'm newer to this issue that's been going on, and I got to meet this wonderful, gentle, humble, quiet guy who I don't want to mess with. And then we've got a wonderful firecracker who just blows up everything and takes charge, and I am so proud. I'm so proud of what we're doing, and I'm proud that we're sharing it. And my husband and I know a young woman who is struggling to stay out of the life, and she's younger. I'm going to guess 24, 25, and boy, every day is a struggle in so many different ways. And I want to see what we can do for her, because she deserves a lot better than what we don't know what we can give her. And it is a daily thing. It is truly a daily, it's an hourly thing. And I want to help her. And it is exciting to know what we're doing, some of the things that are happening again in the community as far as bringing some help to women who are trying to stay out of the life. And I am just so excited to be going forward and to be working harder and doing some things. And Representative Howe and I are looking at some lead good job a bill that would give Chief Bentrud and officers a little bit more control of what's happening at hotels. There's another little issue with that and what they can and cannot do, but we were also brought forward with some ordinance language. And so I hope a lot of places are paying attention to what we're finding out and what we can do for our small towns as far as the hotels as well, and how we can maybe be a little bit more forceful in what is happening there and making them accountable for what's going on in their hotels. And so with that, I'm just very excited to be going forward. This is absolutely a wonderful thing, and I can't thank you two enough, and I just look forward to working again. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Tice. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is more towards the author and maybe other members of the committee and the foster system. You turn 18, you know, happy birthday, you're an adult, you're on your own for the most part. I know there have been some activities to try and help that, but I think related to the situation we're hearing is that we need to try and address that instantaneous transition between having some support and being on your own. And I think that's a vulnerable period of time for young adults. And so when we look at this and other related topics, I mean, you know, one of us could do a bill to try and, you know, do some sort of thing to assist in that transition period. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to Representative Miller on the test scores. And just very briefly, you know, we all have email updates we do every week, and if I don't want to put a lot of pressure on you or a lot of attention, but if you have some, like a paragraph or two that you could share with us, Representative Miller, I'd love to push that out to my network and say, just to build some awareness. I think it's good to educate and get some people excited about this. So thank you for your work.
Thank you, Representative Kreisha. The final question today comes from Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, too, would like to thank Representative Miller for bringing this legislation forward and allowing Family Partnership to continue the conversations about how we can give support to young girls who've been trafficking. So when I think about this issue, we have three people. We have the pimp, we have the young girl who's been solicited, and we also have the John. And I know we are doing a lot of work to really sentence the pimps, you know, and penalize them, and also give young girls the help that they need. This is really a holistic approach. But I'm also thinking about the John, and, you know, we talked about the, in small towns, the impact of embarrassing the Johns. And so I was just sitting here thinking that these are Johns who are having sex with underage girls. They're breaking the law, right? And it's not okay. So what are we doing? You know, I also heard you say that, you know, it slowed down a little bit and then it goes back, because I'm feeling like what has been done about the Johns?
Right now,
Ms. Kendall,
the laws that we have, I'm sorry, not used to this. It's like a jury, only you talk back. Not awesome in that way. I can actually talk to the jury speaking. This is good. The gross misdemeanor right now, if you solicit a juvenile, it's a felony. As I say, we are prosecuting them and we are hanging convictions on them. The demand went down for a little while, but what our victims told us is that their beatings went up exactly the same because they couldn't meet their quotas. When the demand went down, then the traffickers are going, you know, what's the problem? Get out there, get your stuff done. And as you will see in our video, and we'd be happy to share, we've got a 5-minute trailer video where we have a survivor speaking, and she talks about getting beat up by the pimp, getting beat up by the drug dealer. Then she got good at stealing to make her quotas when that demand part would go down, either because she was injured and unable to do the work or do whatever was going on. It does end up being complicated. We are convicting the Johns, and I think if there was a stronger, that needs to be part of this conversation in this study that we're talking about, because what do people want done? In my community, they want those people convicted, and they want the picture on the front page of the paper, and by God, that's what we're doing. In St. Paul, that's not necessarily how it goes. In Rock County, down in Laverne, it might be something a little bit different. What we're seeing, what we're mainly catching right now are the people who are soliciting adult victims. The juveniles are harder to get. And that's one of the things that we don't want to tell the pimps in our town what's coming, but we got some plans for that. Once you get into this, just the natural human reaction that I see this group of people having, well, what about these guys? Yeah, let's talk about that. What do you want to happen with those guys? Because just like DWI, just like domestic violence, people, this has been going on since the dawn of time. And I don't know that we need more laws. We need to know, what do the people want the government to do about this? What do you want me to do? And this is where we're going to get that kind of feedback as to what the public policy should be, because you're seeing it different county by county and jurisdiction by jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just for clarification, what are Jones been charged with?
It's a gross misdemeanor crime right now. We keep that crime on their record. They're required to be on probation for up to 2 years. They're required to go to a very specific John school that has survivor participation and input, because we think that is one of the most important things that needs to happen, is he needs to understand what he really just did. That this isn't some sort of side thing that didn't affect another human being. And that's where we're kind of seeing it land with these guys. So another thing that could come from this is, what exactly would the legislature like to see happen every time that charge happens? And then, again, allowing something different from community to community, because what Mr. Choi is dealing with in St. Paul and how he's handling that isn't right or wrong. It's all discretionary under the law. But to have some more informed direction as to how would you like this to go, because right now I'm doing what I think my people want, and I was out in Washington talking about this last week. For the first time in 20-some years as a prosecutor, my name was on the front page of the paper above the fold, first time ever. I'm the Jacob Wetterling prosecutor. I'm the person who dealt with Crossroads ball stabbing. And that, this topic, is what has caught the electorate's attention. How awesome is that?
One more question. So, really quick, two questions. So, in my eyes, you know, a pimp and a John are doing the same thing. And once, so what happens after a John is arrested 2, 3, 4 times for the same thing? What happens?
We haven't had more than two so far.
Ms. Kendall.
Again, a gross misdemeanor. The jail is part of it. I mean, they're getting booked in the jail. They're getting that done. We don't have mandatory minimums on that. That's something that we can talk about. And this is actually where we see this kind of reaction, is what's going on with him. For me, the big ticket item is the trafficker, and I'm getting 13 to 27-year prison sentences because these guys are coming to me with criminal histories. Even the ones without criminal histories, we've got a 48-month mandatory minimum. So the sentences on the traffickers are going well. The gross misdemeanor is, for your average person, almost none of these guys have criminal histories.
Right.
I mean, of the Johns that we're catching. So this is their first crime, and it's a big one.
And I just want to,
Representative,
Mr. Chair, just to reiterate that we're talking about underage girls, right?
Yep.
And I think that's the bigger impact, that these are grown men, as the Johns are soliciting, as the pimps are soliciting the girls, the Johns are having sex with underage girls.
We've caught,
which is very inappropriate.
We've caught 6 of the 112 that were soliciting the girls. Yeah, so far.
We have actually
not rude.
One is too many, clearly. And we've had a few situations where we've actually had underage girls being trafficked. The vast majority, though, are adults. We have made several arrests for individuals soliciting from an undercover officer sex with a minor child, which is a felony crime. We've had several of those, but we actually haven't had a lot of juvenile victims. The concern that I have right now is that our local response, law enforcement response, has actually been pretty effective in that we have changed behaviors. It's still occurring, but you don't see a lot of the ads on social media. Of course, there's been some changes with Backpage and some of that, but you don't see a lot of the hotel work as much, because they know that we're watching it, we're working it. So we're pushing this issue more underground, if you will, apartments, private residence, mm-hmm. and that's going to require even more law enforcement ability to investigate and be able to build cases. So we've clearly changed behavior, but it's just pushed the problem a little more into the shadows, and that's a concern as well. And you know, our philosophy is that we are very victim centered. You know, we have charged a few women for soliciting escort services under an ordinance that we have, but I could probably count on one hand where we've done that. And there's typically a reason for that. There's probably some other, like I said, about 80% or upwards of 80% of the women that we've dealt with are being trafficked. In other words, they're being controlled by somebody. There's a smaller percentage that is probably more, if I could use the term freelancing, kind of independently supporting a chemical dependency issue, a drug issue, and they're doing it to raise money. But we're really victim-focused. We don't look to charge women, but we are pretty aggressive going after traffickers and the Johns, and we've been very successful at those.
Yeah. All right. Ms. Kendall, Chief Bentrude, thank you for your testimony this morning, your time, and thank you for your service and what you're doing for the good folks north of the cities here.
Thank you. Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify for or against House File 713? Seeing none, final words, Representative Miller.
Mr. Chair, I will be very brief. As Ms. Kendall said, Wobegon has gotten the memo. I hope we've demonstrated here this morning that we have a lot of good pieces, but they need to be put together through this strategic plan. So we ask for your support.
All right. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 713 be referred to the Committee on Public Safety. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. House File 713 is referred to the Committee on Public Safety.
Thank you.
Next, we will have Representative Grunhagen's House Files 155 and 156. As he's making his way forward, Representative Grunhagen also moves the minutes from February 2nd, 2017. Are there any additions, changes, or corrections to be made to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The minutes from February 2nd, 2017 are adopted. As he's still settling his way in there, Representative Grunhagen moves that House File 155 be referred to the Committee on Taxes. Representative Grunhagen, welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I have a couple testifiers who need to be at another committee. I'd like to start with House File 156.
Okay. Representative Grunhagen withdraws his motion for House File 155 and is moving now. The House File 156 be referred to the Committee on Taxes. Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This is a bill that allows charity care tax deduction for medical professionals who, on a voluntary basis, help people in need with medical problems, and it gives them a little bit of a reward as far as the state tax deduction based on Medicaid rates. Mr. Chair, I would like to get the bill in the order that I wanted it to have it and move my Amendment A1, which is a technical amendment and clarifies a couple things.
All right. Any questions on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Grunhagen.
I have a testifier here, Mr. Renner, to speak to the bill.
Mr. Renner, welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, Dave Renner, representing the Minnesota Medical Association. And first, I want to thank Representative Grunhagen for his work on House File 156. This is an issue that he's been working on for a number of years, and we appreciate his effort. As most of you know, Minnesota currently has the honor of having one of the lowest uninsured rates in the country at 4.3%. We think this is due to a number of reasons, partly the strong commitment from our employers to offer coverage, and then also the safety net that you all have supported through medical assistance and Minnesota Care. However, despite that, we still have over 234,000 Minnesotans who are either uninsured and even more who are underinsured. Physicians have just demonstrated their commitment in the past and will continue to commit to serve these patients regardless of their ability to care, to pay. The uncompensated care usually is referred to many times as free care or charity care, and Representative Grunhagen is trying to address the issue of charity care. Minnesota Department of Health doesn't collect data on outpatient clinics, but they do collect patient data on hospitals. And their 2015 report showed that over $294 million of uncompensated care was provided at hospitals, and of that, about $120 million was considered charity care. So there's a significant amount of care provided. Much of that, of course, is physicians who are involved in that care as well. So, again, we just appreciate the efforts, because I think we've been trying to address this issue through our safety net and other things, but there there are still those who are do not have the coverage they need, and physicians are continuing to participate. So as medicine continues to be complex and expensive, we appreciate the legislature exploring all different options, including the language that's in House File 156. I'd be happy to try to answer your questions.
Questions for Mr. Renner. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for either the author or for Mr. Renner. Can you just talk a little bit about mechanically how this would work, what it would do in terms of a return to the clinic or to your practice if we were to do this tax credit? Can you talk a little bit about the money?
Renner. Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, I can attempt to. I don't know if I have data or numbers, but as I understand the way the bill is drafted, especially with the A1 amendment, it does try to define what charity care is. A physician and other health care providers that are listed in the bill would estimate how much charity care that they provided based on that definition, would submit a form showing how much they provided, and then the reimbursement or the amount, the value of that would be based on what is reimbursed under Medicaid or medical assistance, which is significantly lower than commercial. So it's about between 30 and 50% of the commercial rate is usually what medical assistance reimburses. So that would be the dollar amount that we put forward, and that individual could use that as a tax deduction on his or her personal income taxes.
And Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, to either of you, if we move in the direction that Congress wants to move, you know, say they want to move in terms of block granting medical assistance, I would imagine that this would be then a device that would cost us more than we might anticipate right now, given the current level of insured here in Minnesota. So maybe this is more for the author, for Representative Grunhagen. Are you anticipating the act by Congress to block grant, and is it your intention then to make sure that providers, at least physicians, are being reimbursed for the care that they're providing when people lose their coverage here in Minnesota?
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question, Representative Murphy. I'm not sure what Congress will do yet. If you know, let me know. I don't know if they know exactly what they're going to do. But I do think that whether it's block granted or the current situation, and I've got a couple examples to close with in terms of how this affects local providers, in terms of getting some type of reward for a tax deduction for giving charity care. But in terms of the what Congress will do, my understanding is they are looking at block granting. I do think that the bill would work well, either block granting or under the current situation. But that's as much as I know at this point.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for Mr. Renner, from your perspective representing physicians, would either reimbursement through medical assistance or a tax credit to providers for charity care amply reimburse providers for the work that they're doing? And that, given the fact that we know that commercial rates are higher than the public program rates.
Mr. Renner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, it's a hard question to answer because what's appropriate levels is always debated. Clearly, physicians in Minnesota continue to serve populations that are in our public programs. They continue to serve populations that do not have insurance. But at some point, there is a level where you can't continue to run a business if you can't cover your costs. I'm not certain if I'm answering your question, but clearly I think at some point the legislature, if we're going to continue our public safety net programs, which we strongly support, I think the legislature has to address underfunding of those programs. I think if our preference, of course, always is that we think all Minnesotans should have some form of coverage. We think that's much better. But in saying that, even under where we have over 94%, 95% coverage in Minnesota, there continues to be a significant amount of charity care provided. And we think this is one way to encourage people to continue to provide that care.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for answering my questions. And I know I'm asking you to answer questions that are hypothetical, barely hypothetical in nature, because it sure seems like something's going to happen in Congress. that I think will interrupt care for people. One of the things that we learned, I think real clearly, with the individual market, this cycle, this past fall in the rates, is that almost every iteration of coverage for people is subsidized in some form or fashion, either public programs, the amount of money that we spend in the federal government to employers who provide coverage is significant. And the only people so far, I think, that have been there were the people in the individual market who weren't getting an advanced tax credit. And this is just one more example, I think, of policymakers, public policymakers, trying to find a way to use tax dollars to pay for care or to subsidize care. And I think if we pulled all of that money into a big pile, the federal money and the state money, we would be surprised at how much there is and how inefficiently we are using that money. I don't have a problem with the idea of providers getting paid for charity care. And if we use the tax code to do it, because it's easier given our politics right now, I understand that. But it is super inefficient. All the different ways that we are putting money into the healthcare delivery system to make sure people are getting access to care and providers are getting paid. And I think if we're going to rip open our current methods of coverage, we should take a good hard look at what's being spent at the federal level and at the state level to do what we're doing and see if there's a better way to do it. So I just think as long as we're going to talk about tax deductions in the tax code to pay for health care, we should just put it all on the table, that we're being fairly inefficient about it and indirect about it. Thank you.
Chair Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Grunhagen. This would also cover dental care, isn't that correct?
That's correct.
Thanks.
Chair Dean.
And I think that if you look at dental care and coverage in Minnesota, it's kind of a precursor to what's happening with Medicaid coverage in greater Minnesota and in northern Minnesota, where we don't have access. And one of the things that I think we're really going to have to struggle with is how to increase access. And this is a voluntary way for people to provide care for people. So currently, if you're a dentist or if you're a physician, you can provide services to people below cost, so through Medicaid reimbursement with lots of paperwork. And what dentists, I know the dentist in White Bear Lake told me that, you know, that the dentist that he knows in the metro area, they would prefer to just volunteer their time than see Medicaid patients. So they volunteer, they feel like that's part of their responsibility professionally to do that. And they do that, and they have no compensation whatsoever, but because they can't afford to have practice time that is compensated if they're at 100% of, if they have no fails in their appointments whatsoever, they're still not able to pay for overhead. So they literally have to reach into their own checkbooks and write out checks to pay for overhead, let alone do it for free. And that just simply is not a model that is working. That's the height of inefficiency for Minnesota. So I think that when we're looking at trying to increase access in greater Minnesota to start with, and in particular, but statewide, this is one way that our big-hearted providers can do that and try to get at least something back for that, not just where they are, but also, you know, even the dentist I think you brought in last time that staff clinics in northern Minnesota near their cabins where we got great need for more access for folks to try to get access statewide. So I think this is something that we should look at and try to figure out a way to work because the inefficiencies of trying to bill and get paid for Medicaid at below rate, below overhead costs are simply not sustainable. So thank you, Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Chair Dean. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question for Representative Grunhagen. I'm wondering how you decided which medical services, medical practices would be covered under this bill. You know, the way it's drafted, it included, medical professionals, chiropractors licensed under Chapter 148, dentists, as Chair Dean mentioned, under Chapter 150A. If I'm reading the amendment correctly, it looks like you add in
It mentions Chapter 147B, which I looked up as acupuncture practitioners, mental health professionals. You know, just looking through the list of sections in the statutes that are also there that aren't covered by this bill, there's physician assistants, respiratory care practitioners, midwives, naturopathic doctors, genetic counselors, alcohol and drug counseling, nurses, optometrists, speech language pathologists, physical therapists, athletic trainers, psychologists. I'm just wondering how you decided which ones to include and which ones not to include under the bill.
Representative Kernhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Freiberg. You left a few out, by the way. No. No, it'd be the same providers and services that are eligible under Medicaid reimbursement with federal match. That's the definition. So if they're eligible under federal Medicaid match services and as a provider, then they'd be eligible under this bill.
Right. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think we're coming to the end of our time here, and I think this is, I've got a lot of questions. I think this is a an issue that definitely needs to be discussed a lot in this committee, because this is something that really has a lot of potentially impact on healthcare in the state. So I'm wondering, even though this is, I know this will go to probably the tax committee, I'm wondering if you have an estimate, Representative Gernhagen, about, you know, what the value would be for a practitioner who was able to use their charity care for deduction. And I know this is, I know it's hard to answer because the rate will vary, you know, the by practitioner and so on, but I'm just wondering, you know, what, because it relates to what kind of incentive this might be for somebody to provide that care. So if you can kind of just give us even a ballpark, you know, what percentage of the visit cost this might end up to be for somebody, that would be great. And then I do have other questions, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kernhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling. Yeah, the, you know, it's a tax deduction based on Medicaid reimbursement rate, state tax deduction, for a provider. They would simply gain a savings of the tax savings, state tax savings, for the amount of the deduction depending on the service based on Medicaid reimbursement rates. So if right now they get nothing, and this would at least give them some type of financial incentive to give charity care and to get a little bit of a reward back on that. And I think you would actually see less Medicaid billing under this bill, because I think the amount of, which was brought up by Representative Dean, the amount of complexity and difficulty working with reimbursement from Medicaid by providers, whether dental or medical, based on my input from my local district, and my sister works with this, a lot of dentists or medical professionals would say, you know what, rather than deal with Medicaid, I'll just take a state tax deduction for charity care. So I think it actually reduce claims under Medicaid, which we know are growing at a rate that is unsustainable for our state.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Gernhagen, you really didn't answer my question. I mean, because if, you know, if a person can expect a return of 5 cents, that's different than an incentive that would give them, you know, $30, besides which you're kind of assuming here that there's no bureaucracy and no documentation required under this, which I think is not a correct assumption. In order to, you know, document what you did and file it on your returns, I mean, I'm sure you'll have some more discussion about this in the tax committee, but my goodness, I don't think you're giving a person less of a burden by doing this. So, you know, first of all, I think that you're, I don't know if you're not answering because you don't know the answer, but whether it's an incentive and how much of an incentive depends on how much a person could expect to get back on their taxes. And so we need to know that in order to evaluate, even begin to evaluate, whether this is a meaningful bill. Secondly, I'm really curious about a number of other things. One is there any method that a provider would have to use to screen people to know whether they indeed are somebody who should get charity care, or is it going to be each provider's definition of what that means? So, in other words, would we be giving a state tax deduction if the person decided that their brother-in-law needed care and they didn't want to charge them for it or something like that? Is this going to truly be people who are in need or who would otherwise be eligible for Medicaid, or is it just up to the provider who counts under the bill?
Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Beagley. Yeah, the, you know, as far, I think Mr. Renner answered part of your question in his testimony by stating the amount of uninsured in the state. And obviously, if the person has insurance or is currently covered by some form of government program, that, you know, unless the provider would decide they didn't want to hassle with the reimbursement for Medicaid, they would give the charity care if they don't have current coverage. And according to Mr. Renner's testimony, there is a substantial amount of uninsured yet in the state.
Representative Lieberman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Grunhagen, a lot of the people who are not getting the care they need are, in fact, insured, and they have high deductibles, and they can't afford their out-of-pocket costs. So I think, you know, if you're really only aiming this at people who are Medicaid or Medicaid eligible, you're missing a lot of people who can't afford to get care. So, you know, I think that's a big problem right there. I think there are a lot of problems with this. I'd like to ask Mr. Renner, while we've got him here, Mr. Renner, I haven't heard from a single provider in my district that they're interested in this, that they want to do this. Not a dentist, not a doctor, nobody. Are providers asking for this? And that's one part of the question. And the other part is, do you think that providers are giving less charity care because they're not reimbursed because they don't get a tax deduction? I mean, you really think that this would actually get providers who are not giving charity care to give charity care?
Mr. Renner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, what we hear from our physicians throughout the state is the concerns about the uninsured, the concerns about the underinsured, issues that you were raising. We hear concerns also about the low payment rates under our public programs. Saying that, however, again, physicians participate in the programs. Almost every physician in the state is serving patients under the public programs. What impact this will have, I can't tell you. This is not an issue that necessarily we've been working on. The Medical Association is something that Grunhagen has been working on, that we have been supportive of his efforts. I think it's a way for the legislature, once again, to acknowledge the amount of charity care that's provided by healthcare providers and to try to encourage people to continue to do so.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, so, you know, I think this is troubling to me on a number of fronts. First of all, I think it turns the idea of charity on its head. You know, when we have a lot of people who give of their time in this state. In fact, I'm extremely proud often to be from Minnesota because of the kind of civic commitment that we see from people from all walks of life. And they don't ask to be paid, and they don't ask to get a tax deduction. And I don't think that the providers that I represent are asking. A lot of them are just doing good work because they know they need to. And I also know a lot of attorneys who give pro bono service to clients, and I know there's a big push from the Bar Association for that. And those attorneys are not asking to write it off on their taxes. There's also a wonderful event in my district called Heats On, where volunteer plumbers go out and check the heating apparatus of low-income seniors and others in our district. And those people are not asking for a tax deduction for doing that charitable work. So I think that if we start to say that providers need to be, you know, a lot of providers probably feel like they're already getting charity by taking our Medicaid rates, right? And that is a very admirable thing, a very Minnesota thing for them to be doing, frankly. And I'm very proud of them for that. But I think that when we start saying that we're going to take charity care and make it tax deductible, and whatever walk of life it is, I think that's really problematic. I think it's going to turn out to be extremely problematic as a tax policy, but just as a social policy, that then, you know, people are, now granted they wouldn't have to apply for the tax deduction, But and I guess that most people wouldn't anyway because the hassle is too great and because they do charity care because they want to help people, not because they think they should write it off on their taxes. So I think this is a very problematic policy. Thank you.
And I thank members for keeping their comments to the bill here and not getting too much into the taxes. I do intend on voting on this bill at 10 o'clock. We will continue the other two bills that are on the agenda for today. Representative Stanstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just two quick questions. One, maybe you have the answer today, maybe you do not, but when you're talking about charity care or charity, how much of it is true charity versus maybe bad debt, providers not, you know, receiving payment for bad debt? I know it all kind of falls under that umbrella, but if you had to give an estimate, how much is true charity versus bad debt?
Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for that question. Representative
Sandstead.
Sandstead. Okay. Yeah, there is a provision in the amendment, I believe, that addresses that, the A1 amendment, that it can't, you can't use bad debt to write it off.
That's not my question. My question is, in the scope of this, do you have a number that you could say, really, you know, I know a lot of it, people consider some of the bad debt to fall under what is considered charity. I know it's not speaking to that in the amendment, but how much of the problem is really bad debt is what I'm getting at.
Mr. Renner will answer.
Mr. Renner. Mr. Chair and Representative, I don't have an exact number for you, and that's always a challenge of how do you define what's charity care, what's bad debt. The only number I would refer you to is what I mentioned earlier, the Department of Health study, at least on hospital, and they said that in 2014, over $294 million was uncompensated care, of which they estimate about $120 million was charity care.
Okay.
So some of that uncompensated care is uncollectibles and bad debt.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, one more question. Should this go through, would providers be limited to only service rendered to Minnesota residents, or, for instance, could missions trip services be covered?
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Ms. Chair. When you say mission trips,
oftentimes,
if you want to clarify there.
Thank you. Oftentimes, there are dentists, doctors that will, you know, participate in mission trips and go abroad and provide services that back in the States probably would have been covered.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, would any portion of this cover that kind of service?
Representative Grunhagen.
I'll defer to Mr. Renner on that.
Mr. Chair and Representative
Renner.
Again, I don't know if you look at the A1 amendment, the language on lines 1.9 to 1.11, directs the Commissioner of Health to define what is and what is not charity care and makes reference to a current Minnesota rule to look at that. So I think that will still yet to be defined by the Commissioner of Health.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Fagel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Grunhagen, if you assume that instead of providing MA coverage, providers would then instead give charity care, would this proposal impact the number of providers then providing Medicaid coverage or MA coverage? And then how would people find those providers who are giving the charity care? Because, you know, right now they can look at their network and see who is providing the Medicaid or MA coverage, and it's not a very large number of individuals.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Ms. Chair. Thanks for that question. Representative Kugel?
Cagle.
Okay. You know, how would they, I don't think providers would not participate in Medicaid as far as being a provider network. Again, it would simply incentivize providers to do charity care and get some type of minimal reward through a tax deduction for them. Okay.
Representative, Mr. Renner.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Cagle, from the Medical Association's point of view, we would agree with Representative Grunhagen. We're not looking at this as a way to physicians to stop doing medical assistance. Matter of fact, Minnesota has a law that requires physicians to participate if they also want to do state employees and local county employees. So we don't see this as a replacement of. We think that just like we give a tax deduction for anybody to give charitable contributions to organizations, this is a way to encourage that as well.
Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then how would people find out who's doing the charity care? Is there going to be like a website or something?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Renner,
I don't think the bill talks to that. I think it would just be that what happens today is just a way as it's in to say thank you.
Representative Cagle. All right, is there anyone in the 4 minutes we have left who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Please make your way forward and keep your remarks as brief as you could, please.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I would just ask my two testifiers to be as brief as possible.
I would ask that too, Representative Gernhagen.
We're in agreement.
Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Dr. Chuck Sawyer. I'm here representing the Minnesota Chiropractic Association, and I'll truncate my remarks. The issue I want to bring to the table is more focused and specifically refers to the limited reimbursement in Minnesota's Medicaid program. And it goes something like this. Doctors of chiropractic are limited to reimbursement for just one annual exam a year and just a few manipulative services. And yet the patients we see often require more than one exam a year, either because the problem is chronic and the examination needs to be repeated, or more commonly they might present during an annual period with a different complaint that requires a new history and a new examination. And then the other services that we provide, particularly in the area what we refer to as active care, supervised exercise in the office, non-manipulative services that are well supported by the literature and clinically indicated and often greatly assist that patient in their recovery, are not covered under the current medical assistance reimbursement. So what happens in those chiropractic offices, many of which are in rural Minnesota, where there's a disproportionately high percentage of patients that are coming in with either medical assistance or Minnesota care, maybe as high as 60%, those services are either provided by the chiropractic doctor and they simply absorb or eat that cost because they provide the care knowing it's going to be effective, knowing it's indicated in the care of that patient, and absorb that cost, and of course that adds to their overhead, or they seek payment from the patient. In both cases, there's a burden either to that patient or the doctor in the event that they provide the service without seeking reimbursement. So short of any more comprehensive approach, this would be a benefit to chiropractic doctors who would accept the additional burden of submitting an income tax statement that has some documentation of that charity care.
All right, Dr. Sawyer, thank you for your testimony this morning. Representative Gruenhagen, you had one more testifier?
Yes. Yes.
All right. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name and give us your testimony.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and representatives. My name is Nick Doherty, and I represent the Minnesota Acupuncture Association. We represent over 500 licensed medical practitioners here in the state of Minnesota. Our members serve Minnesotans in both private practices all the way up through our large hospital systems. We bring relief to tens of thousands of Minnesotans every year suffering from both acute and chronic medical conditions. We're here in support of Representative Gruenhagen's Bill 156. Many of our members currently work with community outreach programs to ensure that Minnesotans have access to care with the opioid epidemic that's going on both state and countrywide. Many of our members are involved with these outreach programs to help provide these care alternatives and do occasionally have to take on that burden of cost, which does push that burden then on to the providers that are doing that work. So thank you.
All right, Mr. Doherty, we thank you for your testimony this morning. With that, Representative Gruenhagen renews his motion that House File 156, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign.
No.
The bill is adopted. House File 156, as amended, is referred to the Committee on Taxes. With that, members, we are adjourned. Thank you.